Live Line on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry, bringing you great savings on curtains and bedding. Available all year in store and online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You're very welcome to Live Line. Colombo Mungoyne here. If you want to contact us from the north or abroad, you can get us on 08457 853333. You can send us voice notes on WhatsApp at 087-484-8888, 515-51 for your texts, or joe@rte.ie for your emails. Tom Considine, good afternoon to you.
Hi, Colin. How are you?
If you were doing a spec on a job for 18 bikes outside a building, what would be the upper limit, allowing for all contingencies, cost overruns, delays, weather and the rest of it? What do you think the top price would be?
Well, the very top price for a high-spec shelter, I would think, would be in the region of 50 or 60,000 for the shelter element installed. But I wouldn't like the message to go out there that all bicycle shelters will cost 50 or 60,000 or even 120 or 300,000. You can have a very nice 20 bike shelter installed in your car park for 8,000 plus VAT.
Right. So I mean, look, obviously we're talking about this in connection with the Leinster House, the infamous at this stage Leinster House bike shed, coming in at, let's round it to €336,000. It accommodates 18 bikes. So even if there was drainage and resurfacing works of 52,000, and even if there was archaeological works on top of that, you're still nowhere near, you're not even approaching 150,000 in that case.
Correct, yeah.
So when you look at the breakdown of the cost, I don't know whether you've looked down, RTE's Micheál Lehane has published a breakdown of the cost. He's also said, by the way, that the OPW told authorities in Leinster House 3 years ago that installing an uncovered bicycle parking area outside the members' restaurant would have been the cost-effective option. So what's the difference in price between an uncovered bike parking area and a full-on shelter with a roof, which, in the case of this one, some users have complained, doesn't even cover their bikes?
Oh, well, there would be a big difference. If it was uncovered, you're basically just buying bicycle racks or Sheffield stands, similar to what you see on the streets in Dublin there. I mean, they'd be running, you'd buy a stainless steel Sheffield stand for about €200 each. So, you know, however many stands. I looked at the photographs today, I think there's only 13 stands on that shelter. So you'd be into a small, 2,600 stands plus the installation cost. Be considerably cheaper. It obviously gets more expensive when you provide weather protection and enclose the shelter.
Right. But so €121,194.29 were spent on steelworks.
That would appear to be for the shelter structure.
Right. So the Sheffield stainless steel, you're talking about this, like an inverted U with a slightly square bottom on it,
that the bike.
Yeah. And that's if you embedded them in concrete in a normal car park. But if you're to put a layer of granite underneath that to be in keeping with the building, I mean, what are you talking about? Have you ever done a job where there's been stone paving underneath them?
Well, no, typically we've been safety store systems. We've been manufacturing shelters now for 20 years. And it's really just a shelter element that we're concerned with, you know. And typically we would go into a customer and fit it on their existing hard surface, be that concrete or paving or tarmac. I note in the breakdown that they've said 44,000 for granite. I don't know the area involved. I'm sure it's expensive, and it would depend on what level of groundworks needs to be done before they put in the granite. So I wouldn't be an expert on the granite element of it, to be honest.
Right, but I suppose, where would the biggest part of your cost be? I mean, you said, you know, it's relatively cheap to buy the Sheffield stands, the stainless steel stands at about €200 a pop. It's labour, is it? Is that the most expensive part of it? And how long would it take to put one in?
I'd say for us, we installed a very nice shelter, for instance, at the main entrance to James's Hospital. It's a fully enclosed shelter, tough and glass. At the time, it was storage for 50 bikes. The staff there use swipe access to get in and out. So it's fully enclosed, fully secure, very nice shelter. And that would have cost in the region of 80,000. So That's for very high end.
And that's everything, is it? Did you put in the swipe enabled electrics, or did they do that themselves?
The customer did that. St. James's did that themselves. But we supplied, manufactured, and installed a shelter for approximately 80,000. Right. That was an existing paved area. The customer put in some concrete pads for us to fix to.
Right, and that was around 80,000, but the customer themselves put in some basic work, but you wouldn't imagine
some
that
enabling works, yes.
Yeah, that
would have been small money there, yeah.
And a bit on the electrics then, obviously, and that they were security compatible to make it swipeable.
Exactly, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like, you're giving us estimates here that are anywhere between a fifth and a third of the price of the job in Leinster House. Now, obviously, look, the spec you're talking about is different. Yes. And at the risk of doing yourself out of an upper price limit on future work, I mean, are you left scratching your head by how this cost accumulated, or how even, you know, delays or only being allowed work on certain days would even begin to try and account for this?
Yeah, I'm sure it all contributes. Our expertise is on the shelter side. You know, they're saying 121,000 for the shelter element. It would still seem expensive to me, without seeing a drawing in a spec, but looking at it from the photographs and doing back-of-the-envelope costings, I would think shelter for about 50, 60.
Okay, so the breakdown as it stands is 121,000, as I say, €194.29. That's steelworks, but it says manufacturing, supply and installation. 53,000 roughly spent on groundworks, including drainage and surfacing, and the cost of granite landscaping, 44,940. And then it says €30,468.69 was spent on day works, while almost 35,000 of costs related to preliminaries and agreed variations. I'm not clear whether that includes the archaeological work or not. But if you don't, if you'll pardon the ignorance, what are day works?
Day works, it would be, as I understand it, would be daily rate for labour on site.
Right, so that's...
And it could, like, one would presume that the shelter price included supply and install, so the labour element would have been included in that, but there might have been overruns on labour for different people. Different trades might have had to attend sites for different reasons.
Right. You seem to be right on that, because the 121 odd thousand says supply and installation, and the 53,000 was spent on groundworks, including drainage and resurfacing, which would seem to include labour in that. Granite landscaping, 44,000. Not sure whether that's incla or excla labour, as it might be read on the invoice, but 30,000 on day works anyway, and 35 grand on agreed variations. You're still finding it difficult to see how all of that fits into somewhere between 335 and 336,000 euro.
Yeah. I mean, it's expensive. There's no question about it. It's certainly expensive for what you get at the end. But I'm not privy to, you know, the vagaries of that particular site or what they met. All I know is from our point of view, you will park that many bikes for a fraction of the price.
Right.
And I'd like that to be the takeaway for people who are considering putting in a bicycle shelter.
Right. And are you at the upper or the lower end of the market, Tom? When you go out to price a job, you know, is it a competitive market installing bike sheds? Are there a lot of providers like yourself who do these kind of works? And as a result, I suppose, is it price competitive?
It definitely is price competitive, because you can go online and, you know, you can buy a shelter online that's delivered to you in kit form. And then, you know, we would have a whole a range from standard. The curve shelter is the most common shelter that you'll see in schools and industry office parks. And it is price competitive, definitely. Yeah, there are plenty of suppliers.
Right. And if a customer came to you with a spec and said, look, you can't work on this between 10 o'clock in the morning till 11 o'clock at night, Tuesday to Thursday. You can only work Mondays and Fridays, and there may be some weekend work required. How much of a premium does that put on the price in case, you know, drilling, installation, that kind of thing, interferes with noise, interferes with the goings on inside the building? Have you ever had a spec like that where you're given certain hours and you have to work around their working day?
Yeah, certainly there would be jobs where you could only install after hours or install on weekend, but that, it would only affect the labour element of your job, you know. So the common 20 bike shelter that we supply and install for 8,000 on existing hard surface for a customer, if that had to be done at weekend, it might add 1,000 or 2,000 to the overall cost. You know, 20% maybe. Your 8,000 shelter might become 10,000.
And do you know many other companies working in this area? Are you on speaking terms with them? Is this, you know, the talk of the bike shed installing community at this stage?
Well, you know, it would be, but I suppose people wouldn't be entirely surprised either, given, you know.
Oh?
Well, no, I suppose we don't, it's hard to comment because we don't know what the entire scope of the job was, how big an area. You know, was it literally just the ground around the shelter, or was an awful lot of enabling works to be done? You know, you need to know more about the job. But I think everybody, even people who are not involved in bicycle shelters, anyone would concede that it's for what they got at the end, it was very expensive, that's for sure.
And is there a difference between the price that's paid by the public sector and prices paid by the private sector in the general run of things for jobs like these?
No, not for us anyway. No. Our shelter price is our shelter price. It wouldn't matter who the customer is.
Right. And how do you get the work, if you don't mind me asking? Do you have to put in for a tender process above a certain price, or what way does it work when you're looking for work like this?
Well, typically if it was public sector, it would be tender, maybe on e-tenders, that portal, that website. And then, but then for us, a lot of our customers would be, you know, business to business. That'd be, as I say, schools, hospitals, industry, offices, and they would find us on the internet, safetystories.ie.
All right. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, Betty, you've been listening to Tom and you've been listening to the news of the bike shelter since the story first broke. €336,000, I say. Tom says he's slightly mystified as to how that bill racked up. He's puzzled. You're angry.
Yeah, sorry, my voice is a bit hoarse now at the minute. I'm wondering who signed off on €350,000. That quote was given before that bike shed was done. Your listener there, Tom, €8,000 for a normal bike shed. We're talking gold here.
I mean, I suppose once the reasons for this overrun, or whether it was an overrun or not, or what the sign-off was, becomes clear. But anyway, you don't agree without coming to the conclusion before any look into it is had. You certainly don't agree with this, and you can think of better uses for €336,000.
Well, as you know, your researcher rang me there a couple of weeks ago before the abuse stories went on air with Joe Duffy. She has two autistic children. One of them she had to pay €8,000 to have assessed. That was between specialists and the whole lot. The second lad, non-verbal, she cannot get assessment on the HSE. They noticed that a year and a half that is special. He's 3.5 now, and they have to wait between 2 to 3 years more to have that child assessed. They were willing to try and find the money to get him assessed privately, and there's a 2-year waiting list on that. Now, I reckoned up, Colin, if you just bear with me for a minute, €350,000 or €340,000 would pay for 14 special needs teachers per year, would pay 14 nurses' wages per year. This is absolutely ludicrous. I have 6 children and they're paying up to €100,000 a year in tax. Now, I deserve to know what is going to be done about this. I don't want to put on the long finger. I don't want to have to say that I can't stand living in Ireland anymore. I want to go abroad because I just can't take it.
All right. Neil Hogan, you've been listening to this. You've heard Tom. I don't know whether you were listening to Tom there who ran us through the spec. I mean, do you think he gave us an upper limit of about €80,000 in his experience of installing these things. Maybe not with the granite trimmings, but we're still only clearing 100,000 at this stage and nowhere near the 336. But
if it cost 50 grand, I'd still have been surprised. But look,
Right. You installed one yourself, did you?
I did, just at the side of my driveway. I'm very proud of it. And I'm looking at it right now outside my kitchen window.
Right, describe it to us.
Set the scene there. It's like you described, an inverted U one. So I bought that from a company. They delivered it to the house, which is great. I think it cost about €100 10 years ago, a bit less than €100,
including delivery.
Including delivery. Okay. It was a really great guy, great little company, and they dropped it round. I just bought one. I didn't think they'd deal with someone just buying one, you know. So, but he dropped it round personally, and I went down, got 3 bags of fast setting concrete.
All right, how much was that?
I can't remember, but they're not that expensive, you know. Okay. I've no idea. I wouldn't remember. I'd say maybe €20 a bag, you know, fast setting concrete.
Right. Did you have to hire a cement mixer, or did you mix it yourself?
No. You mix it yourself and just pour it in and work fast because it sets fast. And you know, uprooted a couple of bricks from the side of my driveway, dug the hole, maybe 18 inches deep. And
did you find any archaeological remains down there while you were digging? No lost treasures,
no,
buried Vikings,
no,
ancient artifacts.
No, not at all. No, it's not an 18th century house, thank all God. Right. But no, it's just you know, people should do it. It's great,
100 quid, you know, for the steel. You know, whatever.
Let's say €100 and €20 a bag. So maybe
that's 100.
You know,
we're up to 160. Let's say, let's give an upper limit of a fiver each for that. How many bricks did you have to uproot, would you say?
The bricks, maybe
20.
No, about 10, 12 bricks, I'd 12 say. Bricks. Even 10, if we said 12 bricks.
Let's call them a fiver a pop.
And I did have to. God, you're being very precise here. So I better tell you, I also used a concrete block. So you split that, I used half of the block.
Two halves of a cavity block to have a ready-made holder for your two
bolted
legs.
Bolted the thing, bolted the ends, the two ends of the U-stand into the concrete blocks, and then put the concrete block sitting in the into the two holes, and then pour the fast setting concrete around it. So I'm very proud of it. I reckon you could smash a digger truck into it and it wouldn't give way.
Have you tried?
You know,
anybody accidentally backed into it yet in the family?
Well, loads of vans back up onto my driveway because I'm kind of the second last house, so they back up to cul-de-sac, so they back up. And I used to always be afraid, they'd back up into my front door, but I've no worries now because they wouldn't get past that bicycle stand.
And have any of them given it a knock?
Nobody's given it a knock that I know of. Maybe they haven't, but it hasn't budged.
Right.
You know?
So you're looking at not including your own labour, which I'm sure doesn't come, I'm sure doesn't come cheap. But I mean, I'm so far only calculating about €250 to get in this bike stand, plus the peace of mind that it gives you for not backing through the door of your house.
Sorry, say that again.
Well, it's giving you peace of mind, an invaluable peace of mind as well, that vans
invaluable
won't back through the door
peace
of
mind.
Your mind. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right.
I can rest easy.
Right. Yeah, you haven't installed a library by any chance, Neil, because I see Michael McDougall, the Senator, former Attorney General, Minister for Justice, also writing about the cost of changing a library in the Houses of the Oireachtas into a speaking chamber, so all business can be run at the same time. And the works on that are apparently going to cost €3.7 million, and then another €1.6 million ongoing every year. That's Michael McDougall writing in the Irish Times.
The source of that is
the House of the Oireachtas. Okay, so
I do have a lot of books, and I'm pretty handy at putting up shelves as a result of buying all the books over the years.
This would be taking down shelves and installing desks, I think, and a few microphones. Could you turn your hand to that?
No problem.
Right.
No problem.
And how would you be as a fitness instructor? Are you a good motivator?
a good motivator.
Yeah. Are you good for geeing up the troops?
Yeah, I can motivate myself. I don't know about motivating others, but yeah, I suppose I could crack the whip and get people into shape, all right.
Right.
You know?
Do you go to the gym?
I swim a lot, you know.
Nice.
So yeah, I'm an old age pensioner now, right? So I've got to stay in shape. So yeah, I'd swim maybe every second day, and on the other days I would do a 20k cycle.
Right.
So I'm about to go out for a cycle today.
Well, the freelance journalist Gordon Deegan, who submits a lot of freedom of information requests and supplies them to a lot of national newspapers. I see the Irish Examiner is publishing a story today that almost €190,000 is to be spent on a fitness instructor. I don't know whether that's multiple fitness instructors or anyway, there's for TDs and senators in Leinster House. So when you got done at €200 a pop for the 18 bike stands, we're up to 3,600. You're nearly doing the shelf destruction for free. You could turn it. We'll negotiate that price later. How much under 190,000 euro do you think you'd come in to supplement your pension as a fitness instructor there? It's €3,390 per month.
Well, for the whole house, I would say you could divide that by at least 100.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, well, cheap at the
price. If my maths is right.
Cheap at the price, Neil. Number with Liveline. You'd be happy for us to pass it on to the Houses of the Oireachtas if they have any work going.
Oh, I'm ready. Ready. I'll loom up my bike from the stand and I'll be around at the dial within 12 minutes.
You don't sound like an old age pensioner, Neil. Not that there's a single sound of it, but you've obviously, all the swimming is obviously keeping your voice in good trim.
And I'm 2 days off the cigarettes as well. Maybe that's... wish me luck on that, will you?
Yeah, the very best of luck. Take it one day at a time. I know one individual who swore by Hall's Mentholyptus menthol sweets to give them that sort of to replicate the old inhale menthol sweets or menthol chewing gum or the like. So yeah, hopefully.
Well, after I've cycled around to the Dáil to give them my advice in the library, I'll head into town then and get the what did you call them again?
The which? Oh, the it menthol sweet of your choice, Neil. We won't be prescriptive. All right.
Listen, thanks for the call.
Not a worry, Neil, and thanks to Betty and Tom before that as well. Back in a minute.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Colm O'Mungain here. Now, you've probably heard that a lot of the bigger companies, big multinationals, Amazon was named most recently as one of the big companies that's trying to get people back into the office after all the workers, at the risk of sending you all into post-traumatic stress disorder. The COVID work-from-home practices are being ended by a lot of companies. Amazon is one of them. And you've also probably read and heard in the news about the difficulties about Connolly Dart Station and the delays with trains coming in there. So what's the connection between the two of them? Well, Jennifer is one connection between the two of them, because the double whammy of being called back into the office and having to commute by train, she's hit on the double with that. Jennifer, good afternoon to you.
Hi, how are you?
Tell us about, first of all, what your working life was like when working from home.
Well, it was a lot more convenient because you're not having to get the trains in and out all the time. So you're saving a lot of your own personal time, which is really good. And I find that the work-life balance is a lot, the work ethic is a lot better then as well, because you have a bit more energy to be working. But now with the trains, we're kind of, it's about 4 hours. It's 2 hours in, 2 hours in the afternoon to go in and out and commute every day.
And how far are you travelling? Well, you know, give us the distance that you're covering in 2 hours each way.
From Kildare, so from Fallon's to and from each day.
And so is this, you know, as I said there at the outset, Connolly Dart Station, there's one train, for people who don't know, that commuter line coming in from Kildare, one train goes directly into Houston, and some people take the Lewis up there or take the 145 or one of the other buses further into the city centre. The other option coming in from there, if you're working around the Grand Canal Dock area or further south, you need to connect with the Dart, comes in and loops up around by Drumcondra and down through Connolly and Pearson and on to Grand Canal Dock. Is that the train you take, is it?
Yeah, I used to go straight to Pearce and I'd get in about 7:30 to Pearce and then I'd be another 30 minutes just to get into my office, which would be over in Portobello. But now I'd have to either get the train and get in at 7:00 in the morning, which is a bit too early if I don't have to be in the office until 8:00. And in winter, I'm kind of a bit nervous as well because I'll be in Dublin at like 7:00 by myself and just a laptop bag, nobody knows what's in it. And I have heard of some mugging, so it's just a bit too creepy in that time of the morning.
Right, so just winter in the dark and you on your own with the laptop, you'd feel fairly vulnerable as you transfer between. How many modes of transport are you taking?
So it's a train, so a commuter train, then it's the Dart, and then I have to walk a bit, then I have the Lewis.
Right, you're going train to Connolly, is it?
Connolly.
Then mm-hmm. change for the Dart to Pearce, then you're getting out in Westland Row and you're walking around the back of Trinity College to catch a bus to get out to Rathmines, is that it?
Yeah, pretty much.
Right, so a bit of hoofing around and the laptop there as well. Has the commuting got harder as a result, by the way? First of all, to take your train journey time first, has the commute got harder with the changes at Connolly?
Yeah, I have to be up at 5:15 now to try and make it if I want to go in the earlier one. Or it's much more strenuous because I just feel exhausted. And at the end of the day, if I have to be moving from one form of transport to the other, moving from one platform at Connolly to the next, and then just trying to hope that the Dart is on time or then they'll be delayed because everybody's trying to make it at the same time now because there's a limited amount of them. It's just woefully stressful these days with it.
All right. And can you get a seat on the train? I mean, it sounds like there's plenty of people, needing to travel earlier. Do you find it's harder to get a seat now that you're
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, it can be because it's just a lot of people on the same platform waiting for the same train now because there's not as many options anymore. So it's just very exhausting with that. You're standing around all the time with your heavy bag and everything.
And are you in every day now, having gone from working from home? Are you in 5 days a week or how many days are you in?
No, thankfully I'm only in the 3 days at the moment.
And is there talk about coming in 5 days a week or people? I mean, I'm sure you probably talk to other commuters on the train, bedraggled commuters at that hour of the morning and on the way home. Is there more of a move amongst your fellow commuters to be coming in 5 days a week?
Yeah, it's definitely rumours at the moment that a lot of people are sort of starting to have to go in at least 4 or 5 days. Nothing set in stone for me just at the moment, but I don't think the majority of people are too pleased with that.
And what,
some people are. Yeah.
And what time are you coming home at then in the evening? So you're in for 8 and you're out at what? Are you out at 4 or does that vary?
I can get out at 4, but then the train isn't until I think 5 or so. So I'm kind of hanging around for a bit. And then it'll take a couple hours to get home on top of that. So it's very tiring.
And is it the same thing in the other direction? You're looking at the bus down to the city centre, the walk back to Pearce Street, the change in Connolly, and then the train from Connolly. By the time the train is leaving Connolly, are you looking at another full train on the way back to Kildare?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes, it's very tiring.
And do you have time for anything else?
Not when I go to the office. If I'm working from home, I can kind of do a bit more in the mornings and I can do a bit more in the evenings, but like, it's a bit more, I'd be very like exhausted then by the time I get home.
Right.
I mean, from the office. And
how common is that kind of multi-stage journey? Because I mean, look, if people are travelling from where you are into Houston Station and they're very close to the city centre, they're within walking distance, then, you know, it's a relatively short hop, especially if you're getting on one of the intercity trains that doesn't stop at the intervening stops, which is kind of, you're living the dream, relatively speaking, if you get one of those trains. But in terms of people with the amount of stops or the number of stops that you have, how many commuters are on the same kind of grind as you?
Well, I know people that I work with, my co-workers would be the same, but then, I mean, there's a lot of big companies around my neck of the woods. So you have EY, you have Deloitte, then you have like Facebook, Google down in Grand Canal. So they're, and Accenture as well. So they'd all be massive companies and a lot of people would be commuting on that sort of line. Because, I mean, I'm down in Salins, it's a commuter town, so there's a lot of people that would be getting the same train in and out every day.
Right. And is driving an option for you?
I mean, it is, but it's expensive. And then, I mean, we're supposed to be not driving to try and save the planet a bit. So we're trying to do our bit, but then we're kind of not giving them any options anymore with public transport. And there's talk about giving us more options with public transport, but it feels like it's just being taken away instead.
So you'd be looking at, obviously, I think the cost of driving in and out could be, 60, 80, 90 euro a week, depending on how much traffic it gets stuck in. And if you were driving, and I appreciate you don't want to be, both for kind of ethical and practical reasons, but would you be paying for parking if you were driving in as well?
Oh, yeah, and that's a whole lot as well on top of that. So it's all very costly, and it's still the little options in the city to do like a full day of parking as well. So you still have to commute on like the Lewis or whichever as well, like on a park and ride.
Right. And were you living anywhere closer to your workplace before this?
No, I wouldn't be able to afford to, not with the cost of living, unfortunately. A bit too pricey for that as well.
Yeah. Is there a disadvantage, to working from home? Did you find that the kind of the climate changed with regard to, how working from home was viewed? Were you missing out on sort of any inside track in the workplace, or did people who were going in more enjoy any kind of an advantage? Or would you hear of those experiences from other people you're dealing with who have that kind of balance between working in and working out?
Well, for my job specifically, I feel as though I have a good balance, and it's obviously you have a lot of catch up with people, and specific things are easier to deal with when you're in person. But in my experience, it's always been very good communication, whether it's on Zoom or it's in person. I've never really had a problem with that. So I understand different jobs would have different experiences.
Yeah, and do you buy the annual tax saver ticket? I mean, how much roughly does annual travel cost you? Because I think the combined ticket used to be about 2,000 euro with the excluding the tax relief for people doing the combined bus, Lewis and commuter train travel. But I don't know whether that's the cost of it anymore.
No, I'm just on the Leap card, which is around 9 euro a day now, plus parking, whether it's at the train station to get the train or whether I'm in the city.
All right, okay. All right, well, look, the best of luck in navigating that. It sounds like we need to wish you well with the continued working from home, at least for some days of the week. It doesn't sound like you relish the prospect of going in 5 days a week, if it's at all feasible. Thanks for talking to us today. We're back after this.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Now, you mightn't have been glued to the UN General Assembly that was meeting in New York this week, but one intervention by the Hollywood star, multiple Oscar winner, Meryl Streep, did draw some attention. It's unfortunate in some way that it was required. A Hollywood star was required to draw attention to an issue that's been ongoing for many years now, and that is the situation of women in Afghanistan since the return of the Taliban in August 2021. We're joined by somebody today who was listening very keenly to what Meryl Streep had to say and read her remarks, somebody with up close and personal experience of it. Nadia, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon. Thank you so much for having me today.
Yeah, it's nice to talk to you. Well, I should say again, because 3 years ago we exchanged WhatsApp messages when you were still in Afghanistan, indeed in Kabul, as it was falling to the Taliban, and you were trying to escape at that time. I mean, you had experienced the sharp end of the Taliban, not just attempts to silence through the law, but an actual physical violent attack on your own, I think, graduation ceremony when you were a student.
Yeah, my own university,
So their opposition to women in education took the form of violence where you were concerned.
Even before, before they took over the country, like we had school bombed and university got attacked, and I was like one of the victim in my own university, which at that time when we had a government, like proper government. So it's not just they started now; it was like they never wanted women to go to school and universities, even before they took over the country. That's why I think they have targeted few schools and universities even before they come to power.
And when you were in university in Afghanistan, I mean, tell us about your ambitions, the work that had taken you to university, and what your dreams were of living in Afghanistan and working in Afghanistan.
Like, as an Afghan woman, when you grown up in a war zone country, and then you see that every day, you just feel that this is a part of life, and then you don't see that as a threat. Well, it is a threat to you, but then it's also part of your life. You have to go with it, and you have to continue living. And that's what I did. I continued living. I went to university, and my university got lost, like, very badly. I lost my friend. I lost professors. And then that couldn't change my mind to not go back to university again. I did went to the same university. I finished my university in there. I went to an English one, which I could speak English now. And they couldn't stop me, but because I think at that time it was a bit possible to go and still get education. But at the moment, there is no way, because there is no one in there to support the girls, especially to go to university or go to schools or do a job. And once I finish my university, I start working in the humanitarian sector for education, especially for girls' education in Afghanistan in the villages. I did that for 3 years while studying and working for a humanitarian NGO. And after, yeah.
And when you were going around the villages and helping with the education of girls with an NGO, I mean, what was the response of young girls to education? What was the hunger like for young girls to follow the path you'd followed into further education?
They were asking me that, how you get this job, what did you study? Like, you could see in their eyes that they really wanted to go further, and they want to become, like, most of them wanted to become, like, teachers and doctors, which is very interesting for me, because we do have lack of female teachers and we do have lack of female doctors in Afghanistan, even at that time when we had, like, a proper government. Even the small kids, which were in grade 1 or 2, were coming to me and then asking me, the teacher, how did you become so talented? And then you're coming here to our village, and then you're talking to us, and then you're bringing us some stationeries and stuff, which the NGO that I was working with was providing some stationery to the kids, to the primary school children. So you could really see that they wanted to go further and they want to become something, because somehow in most of the villages, the women die at delivery time because there is no female doctor in there to help them. So they wanted to become something and help the people in their own village. So it was really nice to see those kids and their passion for education and all the motivation. But then at that time, there was a hope of them becoming something in the future, like a teacher or a doctor or an engineer, whatever they wanted to, because there was projects and there was a government who wanted to support those girls. But at the moment, I don't feel that anyone is even talking about those people in there. And it's really, really sad, because it's not a small country. It's a country of people with more than 30 million population.
Now, when the Taliban were in control from the 1990s up until 2001, women's rights were rolled back. It's happening again. We've heard recently
the
UN Secretary General talking about women being literally silenced, not being allowed to speak above a certain volume, not being allowed to sing.
Yeah, no, it's not even in your own house if you're singing for your child or if you're trying to play with your kids, because in some families they have already lost their husband in the war, or they have already lost their brothers or any male person in their family. They don't have a male person in their family. The mother is everything. The mother is a father, a mother, a brother, a sister, everything for a child. So she might do some singing, she might do some storytelling or something to be like everything for a child, but then she can't do that because they have banned it. And then if she wants to go to buy something like a grocery, or just to go to the shop to bring something for the kids, or even thinking of going working, she's not allowed to do any of those things, which, and I saw on the news the other day that 3 million children in Afghanistan are facing malnutrition. It's just, I think, because there is no work in there for most of the families that has no main to go and work.
Would you just explain what the significance of not having a man in the house means? Because a woman has to be accompanied by a man to leave the house and do anything. Is that the case?
Yeah, that is exactly the case, because some families, like, they are just sisters. They don't have any brother, and their dad died in a war or something, or due to an illness, or maybe something happened, because we have lost loads of life in Afghanistan for the past 20 years in the war between the Taliban and the government. And then most of the families, they don't have any male in their house. And then if they do, they might be at work, so they can't go by themselves to buy groceries or to do any other shopping.
And
so there should be a man accompanying them, all the time.
And increasingly, they can't go out to work. There aren't places of employment. Even foreign non-governmental organisations, charities, UN agencies, women used to work with them, but that's no longer possible.
No, because I used to work there myself, and I still have friends in there. And every time I talk to them, they're like, it's not the way it was before. Like, it has completely changed, and sometimes we do like small work from home, but then that's not enough, because if you want to earn money, you have to work full time. So it is really hard, because and then there are a few NGOs or charities who do want to support Afghanistan with the inclusion of women working in the same organization, but it's not possible. So they're trying to put some pressure on government to include women, and that's how we're going to support you. But then they don't agree on any of those things. Even the children die, I think they don't care, because they're not allowing women to go and work there. I have my brother and my sister-in-law still in Afghanistan, and we talk with them like all the time, and every time we listen from them, it's so heartbreaking, because we always had war in Afghanistan, but I don't think this is the Afghanistan that I grown up in, because in the past 20 years, it was a different place. Like, I still had the right to go, and sadly, I had the right to go to work. Apart from the other violences that was happening, sometime, or I would say most of the time, there was attacks or bomb blast in Afghanistan. But then you had some rights. But then I think now there is no rights for you, especially you are a woman. I think it is a big crime for you in Afghanistan if you're a woman. That's why every single day, or I don't know, every month, they are publishing new rules and law just to completely eliminate women from being in Afghanistan, I say.
You're living in Ireland at the moment, but you know, and you've been here. You left Afghanistan in 2021. So, I mean, knowing what you know, or knowing what you knew about the Taliban and the risk your family was taking, you had worked with non-governmental organizations and foreign aid agencies. When the Taliban took over Kabul, and you had already suffered violence at the hands of the Taliban, what was your reaction, and how did you feel?
Well, I was thinking that these are the last days of my life, because I had no hope. And I was thinking that my entire family, we were thinking that we will gonna die, but then I don't know that in which way, because there was no hope, like there was no ray of sunshine, I can say, or there was no ray of hope for us to survive in there anymore, because it was very scary, it was horrific, and the way they entered Afghanistan, and especially Kabul, which was the center, which is the center of Afghanistan, still it is the center, was very, very scary. Like, even now that I remember those days, it makes me sad, and then it fears me out that I don't know how to explain, because being in that situation is different than explaining it to someone else, because we have to left our home and go and spend some time with my aunt in their home, and then we have to left her home, and then we went to my dad's friend's house for another couple of nights.
Why? Because the Taliban were searching the area for people.
visiting the area and then searching for any type of documents that show that you have worked with foreign countries, or, for example, European countries or US-supported projects or anything like that. So we have to burn all the documents. I have to burn, like, my school certificate, my college degree, whatever I have. Like, my entire family has to do the same. And we couldn't bring any certificate. We couldn't bring any document with us to Ireland. The only thing that we had was our passport and the visa that we got from the Irish government on a piece of paper. That's everything.
Well, the piece of paper you got was, you know, a guarantee that you would be given refugee status at the point of arrival in Ireland. But it didn't guarantee you safety in transit. You had to make your own way to the airport, and the Irish government was not in a position to provide air transport for its own civilians, let alone anyone else who was giving. So, I mean, as you you didn't know that at the time, though. You had to you tried to make your way to the airport multiple times back in August 2021 to try and escape.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, we went to the airport a couple of times, and then we just decided we were not going to go to the airport again, because there was millions and millions of people wanted to flee Afghanistan, and it was risky as giving your life because people die there. People got killed in there, and then people got harassed on the way going to the airport, and then you have to throw yourself in the sea bridge and show your documents to the country that you wanted to go, and then once they approve that you are allowed to come, then they would take you out of the sea bridge. But then when we went there, there was nobody that we could talk to, so the next day we decided that we were not going to the airport again, and the blast happened, and then hundreds and hundreds of people.
This is the massive bomb that the Islamic State Khorasan province. But in case anybody didn't catch it, the sewerage works you're talking about there was an enormous sewerage trench leading up, I think, to the Abbey Gate of Kabul Airport.
Yeah,
and there were thousands and thousands of people packed into that. And
packed into with the children on their shoulder and with the small kids. And then people lost their children in there, because if you once you get into the sewage in the water, people would just walk over you, and then you will not be able to find small children in there. So people just left Afghanistan, leaving their like 2 years old, 5 years old children behind, because they couldn't take them with them. It was a very tough situation. Everyone just wanted to save their life, and then it ended up people getting apart from their close family. Like, I know my brother is not as young as other people's kids, but still we feel the same level of sadness of leaving my brother behind, and then we have to come to Ireland. So
he's still in Afghanistan, is he?
Yeah.
And what about all those girls? You went out into the countryside, you saw small girls, you told them, you know, you were living proof that another life was possible through education. Do you think of those girls and the situation that they're in now, and what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I do, because if I compare myself to those kids, like if I am thinking that I had the right to study at that time, that what is the difference that they can't go to school anymore and they can't get like further education? It just breaks my heart, because whenever I was going to see those kids and talking to them, they were always asking me that when you're going to come back again, because I think somehow they could see like a hope in me and some other friends who were going with me at the same time, that if they are, as long as they're coming over, we will get support and that we will get education, because UN and UNICEF was working in Afghanistan at that time, and they're still working in there, and they were providing enough support to those hard areas that was difficult for government to reach. So they were trying to provide with some school stationery and paying to the teachers to go and educate those kids. But then I am thinking now that what they're going to think, that why these people are not coming anymore, you know, because some of them were like very innocent. They had no access to TV or any social media and stuff. Us being in there was showing that, oh, there's still work happening, and then that's why they're coming.
Stay with us, Nadia, because Zara has been listening to you. Zara, for young girls who aspired once upon a time to go and maybe get a secondary education, they're not going to be able to pursue that now. So, I mean, what is happening to young women of 13 and 14 years of age when they can't pursue a secondary education and are facing a life effectively locked into their homes and now being silenced?
Hello, and I did say my regards to Dahra. For those girls, it is very tough and difficult situation at the moment that when they finish their primary school, they pursue to be prepared until they are young. At the age of like 15, 16, they have to learn how to do housework and to be prepared to get married. And there is happening in Afghanistan a lot at the moment in the villages and even in a big cities that the young girl at the age of 16, 15, 17, they get married and they forced to get married because they have no other choice. And
and get married to whom?
To some of them do to Taliban members. There are small villages that there is no, not any internet, electricity, or access to any help for those family, for those girls. They have to save their lives, and they obey the Taliban, and the Taliban member force them to get married to them. And
at 13 years of age?
At 15, yes. There might be 13 as well, and mostly 15, 14, and like 16, this age, and teenage age. And the big cities that the families, they were educating. They were the girl was in university, in a school. They had like... They already seen the other picture of life, like they already know how to choose their life partner or how to be free. For those girls also it is difficult. They might not obey to Taliban, but they have no choice. They cannot choose their life partner. They have to. And they're gonna get married to someone a little suitable, just someone come to their door and they will get married because of their safety. When they hear from the other villages that the Taliban forced the girl to get married to them,
families are marrying off their daughters to somebody else to avoid a Taliban member coming and marrying their young teenage daughters.
That's true.
And are you still you've been in Ireland since you're here longer than Nadia who's on the other line. You've been here 10 years, have you?
Almost 11 years I've been in Ireland.
And do you still have female relatives in Afghanistan? Do you talk to them?
I have. I have. My family is there. I have three sisters. And two of my sisters, they were in university. They were studying law. And when the Taliban took over the university, they all closed the clubs. And my sister now, they are at home. They do nothing. Just one of them, she's getting married soon, but the other one, like they have no hope, no any alternative to their life to do anything. That they have to get married for their safety, for their life to be safe.
You're an Irish citizen now. Is it difficult telling your sisters about your life in Ireland? Do you feel slightly guilty when you tell them about life in Ireland and how maybe that might make them feel in the situation they're in?
I do. It is it's completely uncomparable life here and there. And mostly I don't talk with them on a video call. I don't want them to see me and feel sad. The freedom I have and there is for my family and all Afghan women in Afghanistan, they have no freedom. They cannot do the things they want in their own time or their own ability, the way they want. And but here I do things that I like to do, and in my own time, my own ability. It is difficult to tell them everything. Mostly talk about my kids. Yeah.
And Nadia, I don't know whether you have still female relatives in Afghanistan, or if you speak to people there, or if you hear about the lives of your family. You do have a sister-in-law there, do you?
Yeah. My sister-in-law and my brother, and they have two small kids of a baby girl, like 4 months, and a baby boy of 2 years old.
And if your sister-in-law wants to go out, your brother has to be with her. Is that the case?
Yeah, even with my brother with her, they're finding it hard to go out, because even for taking the kids to the park, my brother said that we were out last weekend to take the kids to the park with my wife, like my sister-in-law. And then she was fully covered with the mask on her face. It was just the eyes open to mind the kids. And they stopped my brother and they told him that you can't just go out with your wife has an open eye that we could see inside the car, that she hasn't closed the eyes. And then he said that she's just minding the kids, so she has to look after them in the car. And they're like, you don't have to argue with us. If you do argue, we have to punish you and fine you for arguing.
So just no. This is the Taliban morality police.
Yeah.
Didn't speak to your sister-in-law, only to your brother about her.
No. They don't speak with the female. I would say if you have a male with you, they always prefer to talk to the men. And they always, if there is like any punishment or something, they say the man that this is going to be your next punishment if you do the same thing again. So they don't even look at the woman. If they have like a man next to them, and it's not even easy. If you have a man next to you, you still have to be covered from your head to toe, and then you shouldn't talk. So if I am going with my dad for shopping, I have to tell my dad that that's what I want, and then he could tell the shopkeeper that we want this. So I shouldn't like raise up my voice telling the shopkeeper that, oh, I want some, for example, apples and grapes. So I have to tell my dad, and he has to tell the shopkeeper. I shouldn't talk to a man directly, even with my male, someone from my home, like a male, like a dad or a brother or a husband or whoever.
Or even a male child. A male child ends up being in charge of their own mother.
Yeah. Like, I could go with my son, for example, of 10 years old, and I have to tell him that that's what I want, and then he talk with the shopkeeper.
And there was a meeting in the last few weeks, I think, in the Albanian capital, Tirana. An awful lot of Afghan women travelled at personal danger to themselves to meet. Some women were pulled off planes in Pakistan. Some were prevented from travelling. Some travelled to this meeting and then travelled afterwards back to Afghanistan despite the personal risk. And the call they made was for the international community not to forget the women of Afghanistan and not to pretend women were not being, not to pretend that women weren't being treated in this way, to call out what they're calling gender apartheid in Afghanistan.
Yeah, no, it is. It is a mental war. It is a mental war that women are going through in Afghanistan. I'm not saying that it's only for female at the moment. I could say it's for both men and women, but it's the worst for the women. Like, they are fighting every day, and it is a mental war, and it could kill people because you can't see that this is happening, but then it's inside every single woman in Afghanistan, like from the kids to whatever age.
And you're in Ireland, you watch the news, and, you know, 3 years ago when you first arrived in Ireland, Afghanistan was probably still in the news as people speculated as to, you know, what the new Taliban government would be like. I think people were talking about Taliban 2.0 and they mistakenly believed that it would be different this time round. But now Afghanistan is not in the news unless Meryl Streep goes to the UN and talks about it. I mean, as an Afghan woman who's still in touch with Afghan women and who worked with Afghan women to try and realise their dreams, how does that leave you feeling as you look at this situation?
It's sad because it's like it's and not even sad, like it's heartbreaking for every, it should be a heartbreaking thing for every person who believes that everyone should have equal right in their own home country. And I remember when I first came in, people were talking about Afghanistan a lot. And even when I was going out, people were asking me, that, where are you from? And then when I was telling them I'm from Afghanistan, they wanted to talk to me more about what's going to happen to the woman in there and then what's going to be the situation and stuff like that. But the more time has passed and the Taliban has stricter rules, it's sad and funny that why these people are not talking anymore, because it's worse than 3 years ago now. It's there's no life opportunity. There is nothing for a female. Like, it's become like a prison where you can't do anything. Like, and your crime is just because you're a woman. So that's the only crime that you have in there. And then nobody talks about it, and nobody, I think, care about those half of the population of Afghanistan. I could say like maybe 15 million is women, they are left behind. I don't know if the international community has any plan for those women, or they don't care about those women or what's going to happen to them. But it is sad that in today's world, like in this century, that people are going to the space. They do like all those big things. We are fighting for a very, very basic right, which is the right to talk and the right to go to the school. It sounds a bit funny if someone has lived their entire life in Europe or US or any other Western world, but then it is the reality of those girls in Afghanistan that they don't have these rights anymore. And then they don't even know that if they're going to get this right in the future, or they just have to be left like that for the rest of their life and they will just die like that, you know?
And 3 years.
There's no plan. I don't see any plan for those people.
And for your own part, I mean, 3 years into life in Ireland, I mean, you're trying to get back into an education. The barrier this time is not the Taliban; it's financial. So for the moment, you're working. You've applied for citizenship, but it is ultimately your hope, your dream to return to education. Is it?
Yeah. Like if. If I would have those basic rights in my own country, I would prefer to stay in there and help the other people. But then if I have no rights, I don't think I would be able to help anybody. I couldn't even help myself, you know. So, I am looking for a better future in here. And I am hoping for a better future for the girls in Afghanistan. Like, I hope something at least change for them, and they don't lose hope, because if you don't have hope, if you don't have dream, then the life will become tough. Because I remember myself when I first came into Ireland, I didn't know what should I do. Should I go study? Should I do some job? And I had nobody to help me, so I was struggling. And then I was thinking that I have all those freedoms in here. Like, if I find a job, I could go and do a job. If I want to study and I find an opportunity, I can go. But what about those other girls? They can't do it. I can't even compare my situation to them now.
And how have you been getting on? As you say, it was a struggle when you first arrived. But how have things been going here in Ireland? How's life?
Well, at the moment, I'm happy because I never had any graduation in my life. I always wanted to go back to university, do a master, and attend a graduation ceremony. That was always my dream. But based on the Irish law, if you haven't completed your 3 years of residency in Ireland, you can't go to university. But if you do, I think you have to pay like a big amount of money for that. So I haven't been to do studies or do anything else. But I am working at the moment, and I'm happy with my job. My family is supporting me, and the Irish people are supporting me. I have learned a lot from the people, and I think everyone is quite helpful to me. And then every single day I am coming to work, I am learning a new thing, which I am appreciating like every single day for the past 3 years that I have here. And I And I did apply for my Irish citizenship a few days ago, which I think is a really nice feeling because I feel home in here now. I don't think that I have any other home if I wouldn't be in Ireland, because I don't feel that Afghanistan is my home at the moment, because that's not the place that I've grown up.
Right. And yet your sisters in Afghanistan, your fellow Afghan women, that's where many of them remain, and often not by choice in the situation they're in.
No. I don't think anyone wants to live in that situation where you have to go through mental war every single day. And if you, I'm sure that people follow the news every day, and then you can see that every single day thousands and thousands of Afghan people are trying to leave Afghanistan, go to Pakistan and Iran. And on the way, because they're trying to go illegally, there's no embassy working properly in Afghanistan now. They got killed, they get raped, they get hurt, they get, like, they're facing, like, a very tough situation or a very tough moments every time they want to leave the country, because it is hard for people to survive, you know?
All right. Nadia Zahra, thanks very much for talking to us today. I mean, I think people should probably appreciate that giving any details of personal life comes at an element of personal risk. So they're speaking up on behalf of women in Afghanistan with, as I say, that potential risk that's there. We're back in a minute.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Colm O'Mungine here. Michael Whelan, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Colm.
You're just back from Afghanistan. What brought you there?
I'm a long-distance cyclist. I do adventure tours, usually solo trips. So I was on the Pamir Highway through Tajikistan, and my intention was to visit the Wakhan Valley, the Wakhan Corridor, which is a remote part of Afghanistan. But that border is closed. So I met two Pakistani doctors who were travelling through Afghanistan, and I went down as far as Kabul with them.
Right, were they cycling as well?
No. I left my bike in Kunduz. The terrain is too difficult to cycle. I had to go through the Hindu Kush Mountains through a 5-kilometre tunnel, and so we travelled by shared taxi down to Kabul.
All right, and when you were crossing, did you need a visa to get into the country, or did you get your visa at the border?
Yeah, the visa process was quite complicated at the border, yeah. But right. I had to go for an interview with the Taliban, and some of the questioning was a bit, you know, they wanted to know what was the religion of my father, and one of them was sitting cross-legged, playing with his toes, and then he touched my face. He wanted to know why I didn't have a beard. So it was, and then the first thing you notice when you get into Afghanistan is very few cars have number plates. So that spells out chaos from the start. You know.
What about women? Did you see many women in public places? And what could you judge from the situation, bearing in mind it was obviously a relatively short space of time you were there?
Yeah, Colm, you know, I was aware of the situation with the women there, but to see it firsthand is quite shocking. You know, I'm the father of a daughter myself, and, you know, the only women I had any contact with in Afghanistan were either destitute or begging. And, you know, they've been removed from all places of employment, from schools. So, the situation is quite grim out there.
And when you say dead, you know, women begging in the street, and were they, you know, on their own? Were they accompanied? What could you judge from the state they were in?
Just destitute. You could tell by their clothing that they were unkempt. They could have probably sleeping rough. I mean, Afghanistan has a huge drug problem as well. I think 1 in 5 or 1 in 7 adults have a drug addiction in Kabul. So you can see the evidence in the wadis and the dried up rivers under the bridges and things. But, you know, I'm painting a very grim picture of Afghanistan. And, you know, but there are nice sides to it as well. I mean, there's one street with it's a kilometre long, and every shop is a florist. They have the equivalent of their Grafton Street, the old chicken street in Kabul, is now a very upmarket, selling jewellery and high-end carpets and rugs. So it has that side to it as well. But, you know, women being removed from the equation is just, you know, it's not sustainable. You know, 50% of the brain power in the country have been told to stay at home. And it's evident in commerce when you're dealing with anything that, you know, half the men that have taken over the women's jobs, they don't know what they're doing. You know, it's just chaos.
All right. All right, Michael, thanks very much for that. Back in a minute.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
That's our lot on sound. Tommy O'Sullivan. Research was by Adam Hogan. The broadcast coordinator was Shane Galvin. And today's programme was produced by Tara Lockery-Gant. I'm Colm O'Mungo and Anna Geary's next.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Their new autumn range will leave you bursting with ideas. View in-store or at harrycurry.com.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815 or send your WhatsApp voice notes to 087 484 8888.